This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The bailout is more casually known as the TARP, Troubled Asset Recovery Program. The assets are still troubled, but they are not going to be recovered anytime soon because Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson announced today he's got other ways to spend that $700 billion. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat, now available at splendidtable.org. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 12th of November. Good to have you with us as the bailout of the U.S. financial industry gets curiouser and curiouser. The sales pitch that Henry Paulson made to Congress to get the bailout bill passed went something like this. Give me $700 billion. I'll spend it to buy up all those lousy mortgage-backed securities. That'll get the banks healthy and the crisis will pass. I oversimplify here, but not too much, really. Today, Paulson essentially said, though, never mind. We'll tell you why and what happens now. Also, what a bailout for Detroit might look like and what happens to renewable energy projects when oil prices go slip sliding away. First, though, Henry Paulson. We told you over the past couple of weeks that there isn't any buying up of troubled assets going on. Today, Paulson made it official. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale starts us off.
Secretary Paulson was unapologetic about the change in plans. He said the purchase of bad assets would have been too slow to help banks, while the new strategy of injecting government capital will shore up banks and attract private investments.
As the situation worsened, the facts change. The thing I'm grateful for is we were prescient enough, Congress was, that we got a wide array of authorities and tools under this legislation. And I will never apologize for changing an approach or strategy when the facts change.
Paulson said he might use some of what's left in the bailout to encourage broader lending to consumers, now that credit card, student, and car loans are drying up. The department is reportedly thinking of requiring that lenders match future government payments with money they raise on their own. And John Deary at the Financial Services Forum says forcing lenders to come up with their own capital eases the perception that the government is choosing winners and losers with its money.
The extent to which you can minimize government involvement by trying to leverage the government's involvement by bringing in or encouraging private capital, I think that that's wise on Secretary Paulson's part.
Paulson is also under pressure to use bailout money to help homeowners facing foreclosure. He praised Fannie and Freddie's plans to set voluntary standards for banks to ease mortgage terms, but stopped short of endorsing an FDIC-backed plan to buy distressed mortgages. He said that crosses the line into a government spending program. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
This is one of those stories where a 90-second news spot just kind of leaves you with more questions than when you started. So for some of the answers, we've called Karen Shaw-Petru with the consulting firm Federal Financial Analytics. Karen, good to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
I wanted to pick up on a couple of themes that John Dimsdale just laid out for us. First of all, why? Why didn't the original plan to buy up those toxic assets work?
Well, they've never tried it. But in part, it didn't work because it was always going to be hard. And not anticipating how hard it was going to be, Treasury was sideswiped when it figured that out and then had to quickly construct Plan B.
Was it the thing that we heard about as that plan was being floated, that you couldn't figure out how to price these assets? You didn't know what they were worth?
Bingo. The assets are complicated. They're hard to price. They're held by thousands of investors around the world. You know, this isn't eBay here. This is tricky.
All right. Well, then why is bank recapitalization better?
In the long run, I'm not sure it is. It's just easier. I think in time it poses significant issues, most notably the question of combining troubled banks into huge, bigger troubled banks, or handing problems that ought better to be resolved by the FDIC over to big banks that then get weaker. But it was easier. It was quicker to corral those nine big banks, put them in a room, and force the capital on them than it turned out to be to run the asset disposition and purchase process.
Here we are 2 months into this bailout program, and still the Secretary of the Treasury said this morning that he is worried about systemic failure in the economy. Did that catch your ear at all?
Anytime he says that, it sure does. It's pretty scary out there still.
Why?
I think it is because we've taken the financial markets from a liquidity problem, which was where we were starting in August of 2007, and a very delayed recognition by the federal regulators and Treasury about how serious that was. Then we moved into a rapid collapse of the housing market, particularly prices and the residential market freezing up. Now we're looking at a recessionary scenario, one thing building on the next, with a sharp drop-off in retail sales and unemployment issues. So that's a lot of scary reality built on top of the liquidity and market confidence issues. And that's the problem Treasury Secretary Paulson was referencing this morning.
Let me ask you sort of a strategic question. It seems now that the government's attacking this problem two ways. One, sort of top-down with the Treasury and the bailout money, and also, especially yesterday, with some mortgage relief. How did that come to pass, and is one better than the other?
I think we need all of them. We need more mortgage relief. The plan yesterday announced with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is a piece of the problem. As you all know, the FDIC is looking at another program that would involve guarantees. We're going to need still more in the mortgage sector. But we've got problems throughout the financial sector, autos coming immediately to mind, commercial mortgages. So there are different tracks for each one of these asset sectors.
Where do the tracks all lead then, Karen?
To you and me and the rest of us as taxpayers, I hate to say it, but that's where right now all the tracks are coming into each one of our houses.
Karen Shaw-Petru is a managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics in Washington. Karen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Wall Street didn't much care for what Mr. Paulson had to say today, or for anything else for that matter. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Mr. Paulson clearly had a lot on his mind this morning. His press conference went for more than an hour. He said he thinks, all in all, the government's been moving pretty fast in this crisis. He said he's pretty confident $700 billion should be enough to do what needs to be done. And he said he is not eager at all to give any of that money to car makers. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and President-elect Obama feel otherwise. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports on what a Detroit bailout might look like if it does come to pass, and what might happen if it doesn't.
U.S. car sales are down about 50% over last year. Michael Robinette is vice president of global vehicle forecasts for CSM Worldwide. He says the government has to bail out the auto industry. He says if GM failed, consider the ripple effects, starting with a supplier of parts to GM.
They would have a problem in a sense that some of their supply to GM helped cover their burden, their fixed costs, and therefore that really question their ability to continue to supply a Chrysler or a Honda or a Toyota.
And if those automakers have trouble getting supplies, it'll make it much tougher to stay in business. Also, he says every town with a GM auto dealership would see its economy suffer. John Blank is a senior industry strategist at Decision Economics. He says there's no good answer.
What do you do? If you don't bail them out, they disappear, or they go into a restructuring that, hard to say how they emerge in a competitive framework where bankruptcy goes on for a year or two.
He says a bailout, even for 2 years, would cost about $120 billion.
That number, does that sound really repulsive? Well, I mean, we've done basically the same number for AIG, right?
Of course, Blank says the government could be faced with every other struggling industry asking for the same deal. But he says it's hard to think of having no U.S. carmakers left in the country that invented the automobile. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
T. Boone Pickens said today he's putting plans to build the world's largest wind farm on hold. Pickens made his billions in oil, of course, but it's natural gas prices that are putting the kibosh on his wind farm. Pickens has been advertising this thing he calls the Pickens Plan like crazy. He wants to use wind and natural gas to get this country off foreign oil. Of course, oil closing at $55.77 a barrel today and gas off 5% kind of throws a wrench into the economics of renewable energy. But Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports now from the sustainability desk there may be a silver, or a green, anyway, lining.
T. Boone Pickens' announcement to delay construction of a $10 billion Texas wind farm leaves a gaping hole in efforts to boost the nation's renewable energy portfolio. The oil tycoon says cheaper natural gas, also used to generate electricity, has taken some of the wind out of wind power. But Berkeley energy expert Dan Kamen says there's an even bigger problem: finding the cash.
It's much more a question of the short-term capital available to initiate a project that is building several hundred-foot-tall structures. Big infrastructure is needed.
And big bucks, something that's hard to come by these days. Pickens' own investment firm lost as much as $2 billion this year as stocks plummeted. Ethan Zindler of the clean energy research firm New Energy Finance says Pickens isn't alone. Major wind backer GE says it's, quote, facing constraints.
I would say in the short run, this is not good news for the industry.
But Zindler says the long run may be a different story.
Because the traditional players, a lot of them have either pulled in their horns or left the playing field entirely, there's an opportunity for new players to come in and potentially earn higher returns because the industry very much needs that capital and needs it now.
And when it comes to capital, Zindler says one industry is still flush: big oil. Throw Congress's new renewable energy tax credits into the mix, and it's an opportunity oil giant BP has already found too good to pass up. Last week, the company announced it would shift the bulk of its $8 billion renewable energy spending program to projects in the U.S. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Given Henry Paulson's change of heart on how to handle the bailout, it's probably no surprise that companies from all parts of the economy are lining up to get theirs, Detroit being Exhibit A. But commentator David Frum says we ought to think this one over carefully.
President-elect Obama has expressed support for yet another bailout package for the U.S. auto industry. Here's the case. Manufacturing is the backbone of the U.S. economy, and the Detroit automakers are the backbone of U.S. manufacturing. There was a time when this argument was true. Back in the 1970s, when Chrysler extracted the first auto bailout from the U.S. government. Not anymore. Time was when General Motors alone ranked among the largest employers in the United States. Today, UPS employs almost four times as many people as the two big U.S. companies, Ford and GM, combined. While the big two decline, Toyota USA, Nissan USA, BMW, KIA are all expanding, and not asking for any bailout. The big two remain important employers. Their troubles are felt up and down the manufacturing supply chain. But, of course, that is true for every industry. Last week, the stock of Las Vegas Sand Corporation collapsed. Bankruptcy seems a real possibility. Indeed, the whole casino gambling industry in Nevada is facing the worst crisis in at least a generation, maybe ever. Casino gambling directly employs more people than the domestic automobile industry. Add in the supply chain for both industries, and casinos still employ almost half as many people as the automobile sector. So what about a bailout for the casino industry? Ridiculous, right? But why right? Gambling is a vice, it's true, but automobiles emit greenhouse gases. The answer is not to bail out both. It is to bail out neither. We bailed out the banks not to save the banks, but to save the rest of the economy. If a crisis in autos, or steel, or casinos, or any other industry threatened to have a similar impact, then, conceded, we'd have no choice but to intervene. But if not, not.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. You can come on back to us online. Our website is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. Just a couple of months ago, we were doing a whole slew of stories about commodities, how prices for not just oil, but grains and metals, too, were going through the roof. It got so bad that people were stealing things like statues and aluminum siding and electrical wiring to sell them off for scrap and making a pretty penny at it, too. But if the last two or three months have taught us anything, it's that the economics of any given industry can turn on a dime. And with growth slowing all over the world, the metals market is having a crash of its own, and those falling prices have created a whole new set of problems, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
At a Los Angeles scrapyard, big machines move mountains of old aluminum siding. It looks like business as usual. Not so, says Scott Horn with the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries.
We are seeing some very frightening things happening that really haven't occurred before.
For years in this business, your word was as good as a contract. But with commodity prices falling, scrap dealers are finding that global trade partners aren't honoring their deals. First, a little context. Last summer, metals prices were hitting record highs almost daily. Then the economy tanked, factories cut production and needed less metal, prices plummeted. Alan Alpert is president of Alpert & Alpert Iron & Metal in Los Angeles. He says trade partners in Asia, mostly in China, have done the unprecedented.
Companies are either canceling contracts, reneging on certain deals, attempting to renegotiate the pricing.
When a foreign buyer refuses delivery, sellers like Alpert have limited options.
Bringing it back, which is very expensive, finding some other consumer that will accept the material, which at that point have to deal with the collapse in the price.
In the last few months, copper prices have fallen 52% and nickel is down 43%. A Chinese firm, for example, can buy metal on today's market for much less than it contracted to pay a couple of months ago. And Alpert says that's exactly what's happening.
It is widespread and truly unbelievable based on the previous history of how this business is normally conducted.
In the scrap industry, contracts are relatively new. Again, Scott Horn.
Mega million deals were done on a handshake.
When metals prices were sky high, Alpert honored his word, even if it cost his company money.
So if we sell it $1 a pound and it cost us $1.30 a pound to buy it, we will buy it and actually lose that 30 cents a pound to cover that contract.
Now that the shoe is on the other foot, some Chinese firms are sacrificing business relationships for short-term profits.
It's going to have long-term implications for some of these buyers. I don't think they realize what they're doing to themselves.
Workers at the scrapyard spent a lot of time sorting metal. In the future, sorting is something Alan Alpert will do with trade partners.
Now the question is, who can you trust to do business with? If you're not sure that you will get paid the price that you have contracted for, everything goes out the window.
Unscrupulous foreign firms may find that when the economy recovers and they need more metal, they have undermined their ability to keep those supply lines open. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, the importance of keeping your fan base happy.
Fans are like race drivers in that they're passionate about the sport, and some of them lose patience maybe sooner than others, but the NASCAR fan understands our role in the sport.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial slumped 411 points today, 4.75% to finish at 8,282. The NASDAQ dropped 81 points, 5.1% to end the day at 1499. The S&P 500 also lost 5.1%, 46 points, closed at 852. Predictions that fewer travelers will be flying have the skies looking a lot less friendly. United Airlines lost 27% today. U.S. Airways down 29%. Delta, Continental, and AMR, that's American Airlines, all dropped more than 14%. Crude oil fell to a 21-month low. That pushed energy stocks down. Hess leaked more than 10%. ConocoPhillips lost 9%. Chevron dipped 8.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.65%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, committed to providing health and wellness services through its executive health program at clevelandclinic.org/executive health. And by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. What's the connection between champagne and collateralized debt obligations? Head on over to our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos uncorking the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on the trade balance for September. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act. And a three-day conference focusing on peace through commerce gets underway at George Washington University in D.C. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The man still has 2 months to go until he officially gets the job, but Barack Obama's plate is already overflowing. Just for starters, there's an economic crisis to figure out. He promised to start ending the war in Iraq, and he campaigned in part on a plan to provide affordable health care. Unions, businesses, and consumer groups like the AARP have all called for widespread reforms. What nobody has seemed to figure out yet, though, is how to pay for it. Today, the chairman of one of the Senate's most powerful committees laid down his marker, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports from Washington.
Democrat Max Baucus runs the Senate Finance Committee. It's in charge of setting tax rates and paying for big government programs like Medicaid and Medicare. In the midst of an economic crisis, just 8 days after the election, his first priority is health care reform.
Time is of the essence. The problem is so great. The earlier we start, the better. Failure to act also has such a cost to the economy.
In some ways, Baucus's plan is similar to President-elect Obama's. It would guarantee Americans insurance if they have a pre-existing condition, but it would also require every American to buy insurance, and some workers with gold-plated policies might have to pay income tax on their health care benefits. Obama's plan would include no such taxes, and it would make health care coverage more affordable, but not mandatory. Still, the reaction among health reform advocates was overwhelmingly positive.
I think this is our best chance in terms of getting meaningful health care reform.
Ron Pollack is president of Families USA.
You've got the two leading chairmen of the Senate saying this is their top priority. You've got the interest groups sitting down together to find common ground. And you've got the business community, which is saying, we need this.
The one thing you don't have, at least yet, is a price tag. Baucus's proposal would expand Medicare and Medicaid and require big government investments in technology, as well as subsidizing low-income Americans' insurance. Those reforms just might save money in the long run, but paying for them now will be tough. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
All the talk about the car business and the economy has been of Chrysler and Ford and General Motors. But there is another part of the industry that's hurting, too. NASCAR. The CEO of NASCAR made a visit to Detroit not too long ago. He wanted assurances that the Big Three aren't going to pull their marketing dollars as they try to avoid bankruptcy. The racing season wraps up this weekend in Miami, and there is still at least one NASCAR sponsor hanging in there, barely. From Charlotte, North Carolina, Scott Graff has more on Goodyear's bad year at the Speedway.
If you've ever heard an interview with a NASCAR driver, it sounds a lot like a commercial.
You know, the Zippo blue car was Toyota Camry was pretty good. I mean, the guys back.
We're just out here trying to find something that's going to make our Miller Lite Dodge fast and make all of our sponsors get that warm, fuzzy feeling over the off season.
And companies almost always are left with those warm fuzzies. Keyword. Almost.
Pass the most pathetic racing tire I've ever been on in my professional career. Goodyear can't build a tire that's worth a crap.
After a race in Atlanta in March, driver Tony Stewart vented in an interview with Fox Sports.
If they can't do any better than that, they ought to just pull out of this sport and save us all a bunch of headaches.
Stewart and other drivers thought Goodyear's tire was too hard and made racing difficult. Goodyear has been in the sport 50 years and is the exclusive tire supplier in NASCAR. But this year has been rough. NASCAR has switched to a bigger, heavier car that's harder on tires.
There's been a learning curve for all of us with this new car.
Kerry Tharp is a NASCAR spokesman. He says the so-called car of tomorrow has made it difficult for Goodyear to develop the perfect combination of safety and performance at each track. Goodyear officials say through 35 races, they've used 24 different tires.
They got a difficult job. It's not an easy job to put out a tire that's going to please everybody. There had been some conversations back in the first Atlanta race. Not everybody was pleased with the tire, but it was a safe tire.
But the product Goodyear provided in August for one of the biggest races of the year was dangerous. At Indianapolis, the tires turned out to be too soft. To keep them from blowing out at high speeds, NASCAR threw a yellow caution flag every 10 laps. That forced drivers to pit and take on new tires. Goodyear looked bad. John Sweeney, an advertising professor at the University of North Carolina, sums it up this way.
It's kind of like in the World Series striking out at the critical moment.
The media teed off on the company. Fans lit up message boards. NASCAR couldn't have been pleased, but Tharp, the spokesman, says NASCAR and Goodyear quickly focused on moving beyond the issue.
Let's get this solved. Let's find the problem. Let's analyze why it happened, and let's come up with some solutions, and I think that's what we've done.
After a series of on-track tests, Goodyear thinks the problem is fixed. The head of Goodyear Racing, Stu Grant, says the average fan will still consider buying his company's tires.
Fans are like race drivers in that they're passionate about the sport, and some of them lose patience maybe sooner than others, but over the long haul, the NASCAR fan understands and appreciates our role in the sport.
There have been no major tire problems in the 3 months since Indy, and on Sunday, Goodyear, NASCAR, and race fans will all be hoping for one more smooth ride. In Charlotte, I'm Scott Graff for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the European Union is taking a new tack on consumer regulations. Fruit, not financial. Starting next summer, the EU is doing away with rules that ban the sale of, and I quote here, ugly fruits and vegetables. That is, produce that comes with unsightly curves or blemishes. The ban has apparently been around for 20 years. It's been ridiculed for about that long as a sign of an overeager bureaucracy. In announcing the repeal of the ban, the EU's agriculture commissioner said, in these days of rising food prices, it makes no sense at all to throw produce away just because it looks funny. No matter how we look, we got to go. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow slumped 411 points, 4.7% to close at 8,282. The Nasdaq dropped 81 points, 5.1% to end the day at 1499. The S&P 500 traded down 42 points, 4.7% to finish at 856. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gortz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, a new series, Taking Stock, we're calling it, where we ask economists and observers for their takes on the economy.
We have to say to the bankers, thank you, you do us a great service, but we are going to regulate you, and we're not just going to regulate the rate at which you create credit, but we're also going to regulate the way in which you move money around.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.